From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Corlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Four investigations are swirling around Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his family and associates. They range from bribery and corruption to interfering with the press.
I'm not going to allow Yisrael Hayom to publish a Friday edition, which is the equivalent of the Sunday edition here in the States, a bigger edition that costs more, if you give me more favorable coverage in your newspaper.
I'll talk with International Studies professor Gershon Leventhal about the latest in the investigations. But first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss the ongoing humanitarian crisis concerning the Rohingya in Myanmar and Turkey's missile deal with Russia.
It's particularly surprising, though, considering the situation with Syria. Russia and Turkey have not been on the same side, but they look to be perhaps heading, at least in this regard, towards friendlier relations.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. Rebecca Cruz, let's start in Myanmar, Burma, with the Rohingya. We've talked about this issue before, the violent attacks that are occurring against this particular ethnic group. We now see hundreds of thousands that have fled the country. And, of course, there are hundreds of thousands that are living in surrounding areas since the 1970s and 1980s. But Bangladesh has received a lot of them. Pakistan has about 500,000, the highest number of Rohingya outside of Myanmar. So this is, again, a difficult situation. The treatment of these people is horrible even outside of the country. This is a real human rights issue, given they have no status. So what is perpetuating this violence here, and what are we to expect from the countries where they're fleeing to?
Well, by most accounts, this is disproportionate response by the Burmese or the Myanmar military. There have been a couple of insurgency attacks. There was some this past winter, which resulted in another push of refugees fleeing. And then this past couple of weeks, there were some insurgency attacks on some government outposts. But it's the response that has been so disproportionate. Awful stories of the military going after the civilian populations, specifically going after mothers and children. And so this has resulted in hundreds more trying to flee. As you said, from the 1970s, this has been ongoing. Over a million have left the country. But it seems to be in these kind of attacks that come, and recently the military over responding. I don't know if irony is the right word here, but the leader of Burma is Aung San Suu Kyi, who is a Nobel Peace Prize winner, who was under house arrest for many years, who earned a Nobel Prize because she was seen as an advocate for human rights. And now there is a petition with nearly 400,000 people that have signed that to have that prize taken away from her. UN authorities have been in the country and in the nearby areas and are calling this ethnic cleansing. This is not the first time that word has been used or that term has been used. Aung San Suu Kyi is slated to come and address these concerns next week. By most accounts, at least in previous statements, she has been focusing on this as terrorism, that this is her government's right to respond to terrorist activities and that's what they're doing. So we're not really sure if we're going to see a change in her response, but that's what it's been in the past.
Well, it will be interesting to see what happens with her. But of course, the treatment of these people, as I alluded to, in the countries where they've fled is also pretty dismal. I mean, they have a hard time getting jobs. They really can't work. They can't get ID cards. These are people that have perhaps even been born in these countries. This has been going on for decades. They've had to turn to criminal activity and to theft. And, you know, they have to lie about who they are and where they come from, saying that they're Bengali or something like that. So this is a much broader issue. And I'm sure we'll talk about it again. But let's move to Turkey. A very interesting development between Turkey and Russia. Turkey having signed a deal to purchase S-400 surface-to-air missiles from Russia. Now, Turkey is a NATO member and has been since the 1950s. So this raises issues of military compatibility, which is a requirement for NATO members. Of course, it isn't required that they have to buy all of their military equipment from NATO members. But Russia is certainly starting to perhaps insert itself and maybe driving a wedge into this alliance once again.
Yeah, the complaint from NATO is that it is about compatibility, but others are saying that this really may be more about money and who Turkey is buying weapons from, that they would prefer that they buy them from the United States or the West. It's particularly interesting because Turkey has been in this odd situation where they are sitting between East and West. And, you know, they've been a NATO member since the 1950s. They were looking to get into the EU. That doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon, if ever. And so they are starting to look to Russia. It's particularly surprising, though, considering the situation with Syria. Russia and Turkey have not been on the same side, but they look to be perhaps heading at least in this regards towards friendlier relations. So we'll watch that.
That's an important point, the Syrian point. But Germany also suspended arms exports to Turkey, so that has something to do with it,
yes,
as well. But the Erdogan-Putin relationship is not all that surprising in some cases. But thank you, Rebecca, for being here today.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org, or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU, and I'm at Suzette Grelot. Next, we'll talk with Gershon Leventhal about the investigation of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his close associates. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Four ongoing investigations in Israel are circling close to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The cases involve bribery, corruption, and interfering with the media. Gershon Leventhal is a visiting professor of Israel Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I spoke with him about the investigation. Gershon Leventhal, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
I think welcome back. I think we've had you on the show before, so thank you for being here again. And this time we're going to talk about Israeli politics, considering the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is being investigated, facing potentially several charges, bribery, fraud, break of trust. His wife is also being investigated and I think recently indicted. So this is a concerning situation for domestic politics in Israel, because this man has dominated Israeli politics for 8 years. He's the longest serving prime minister since Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. So can you give us a lay of the land here, kind of set the stage for us in terms of what exactly is going on, and then we can talk about maybe what some of the implications are.
Sure. I mean, he's been prime minister not just in the last consecutive period since 2009, but he was also prime minister in the 90s. So altogether, it's a lot of time that he's been prime minister. And he was investigated already in his first term in office back in the 90s, which is quite remarkable that one would think that he's learned his lessons, but apparently he hasn't. So there's right now, if I count correctly, there are four major cases that somehow involve him and another one that involves his wife. And that's besides a number of different cases that have been looked into and closed, or ones that perhaps still haven't developed into major cases. That, you know, they include things like mistreatment of the workers of the prime minister's residence, the care for his wife's late father, employing an electrician every weekend, even on Yom Kippur, which is the equivalent of like Christmas, a day when everything is closed. Why would you bring an electrician to your house that often, and happens to be an electrician who works for his political party? Buying furniture that matched the furniture at the private residence and then switching out the furniture with the official residence. And my very favorite was bottle deposit returns, that they would buy small bottles that have a bottle deposit to gather them all together, then return them and keep the deposit for themselves. I mean, we're talking about small amounts of change, when, you know, $3,000 maybe a year. This is not, you know, we're not talking about big numbers in terms of these kind of things. But the other cases that are being investigated right now are a little bit more serious. So his wife has just been indicted for having received gifts of perhaps around $120,000 from friends, there's the wealthy friends case, but then this is also $120,000 that she's received as in unethical ways of billing the state, basically, for meals that they are receiving. And they, of course, want to have very fancy meals from big-name chefs, and so they're trying to find ways to basically gouge the state, false billing, things like that. But then each case of his is one of we call them the 1,000 cases. So we have the case 1,000, which is his friends, basically that he's received money from, in particular, two very wealthy friends of his, millionaires, Arnon Milchen, who's a famous Hollywood producer, produced Pretty Women and a number of other Hollywood films, and a guy named James Packer, a very rich Australian businessmen. And they have given them all sorts of gifts, and the most famous of which have been a regular supply of Cuban cigars and pink champagne, apparently for the wife, and as well as other things, including jewelry, that they are basically forced into providing jewelry for Mrs. Netanyahu, Sarah Netanyahu, that basically she would send him an SMS to Milchen and say, I would like this jewelry that I saw at the store. And he brought her, and this is an actual case that was reported, an actual incident that was reported, because he's confessed to a number of this now. I brought her this bracelet, and then she complained she also wanted the matching necklace. I mean, it's almost obscene, the demands for these kind of objects that seems to typify both of the members of the family.
But and on the level of other types of corruption you see around the world, I mean, how do you compare this? I mean, I guess Benjamin Netanyahu has been accused of trading favors for favorable coverage in the press.
Right.
I mean, that's
a
little more serious, perhaps, in terms of the kind of trade-offs that you're making. But is this really anything more than kind of just spoiled people really engaging in kind of petty corruption?
Or
does this spill over really into governance more broadly in the country?
We're not talking about Imelda Marcos here, right? I mean, there's no millions and millions of shoes that are hiding somewhere in the prime minister's residence. We're talking about really a small level of entitlement, perhaps. I mean, it's maybe a level of stinginess that has kind of rushed over into a little bit of bribery that we see. I don't think it's that serious, and I don't think any of what I've talked about till now would be anything enough to really topple him as a prime minister, and certainly it's not enough to blacken his name amongst his supporters. The case 2000, though, is more talking about favorable coverage. There's a newspaper in Israel that was started 8 or 9 years ago that is called Israel Hayom, Israel Today. It's funded by Sheldon Adelson, well-known American Jewish casino magnate who donates, of course, to Republican causes, but also to conservative causes in Israel. And he's basically funded this free newspaper that is distributed every day in Israel on the streets to people, that became overnight the best-selling newspaper in Israel because it doesn't cost anything to get the newspaper. And the competing newspaper, Yedioth Ahronot, which dominated the scene for 50 years, has been suffering. And so supposedly, we have recordings that were taped by Netanyahu's own chief of staff that basically reveal a quid pro quo that Netanyahu was saying to the publisher of Yedioth Ahronot, the rival newspaper, I'm not going to allow Yisrael Hayom to publish a Friday edition, which is the equivalent of the Sunday edition here in the States, a bigger edition that costs more, if you give me more favorable coverage in your newspaper. This sounds like much more than just unethical, gifts that are being given. This is actually, we're talking about intervention into the press. And we add to this the fact that Netanyahu has dominated the communications ministry, either as the communications minister, which he holds in addition to his position as prime minister, or like right now, where he dominates it through someone who is the minister of communications, but he's essentially someone who is beholden unto him. And so here's an issue that we're talking a little bit more serious grounds. Ari Harrell, his chief of staff, has turned state's witness. He's providing lots of information that relate to both case 1000 and case 2000. This is probably the reason that we see this indictment looming for Netanyahu in the future, perhaps as early as October. He could be facing an indictment for both case 1000 and case 2000. Now, both of these cases are ones that he's being investigated personally. But then there's also case 3000, which is the most serious corruption case ever in Israeli history. And this involves a purchase of submarines from Germany, from the German company ThyssenKrupp. And here, Netanyahu seems to be up to his eyeballs, even though the police are still emphasizing that he himself is not the target of the investigation. Perhaps we should put in parentheses yet. Here, his buddy, his best friend, his confidant, his cousin, and his personal lawyer, David Shimron, is under active investigation right now for having made an effort to push the Israeli government to purchase more submarines and to purchase from ThyssenKrupp without there being a proper tender. Now, here there is also a state's witness who is Miki Ganor, who is the representative of ThyssenKrupp in Israel. And this has brought in, it's like, maybe I'll use a sea metaphor since we're talking about the sea here, but they've tossed that net and they've brought in a whole sea of very, very large fish from the Israeli military industry. In particular, we're talking about the former chief of the Israeli Navy, the Rear Admiral, Eli Marom, who is also seemed to have been caught up in this, a former minister, and several other very important figures. We also have the question of whether Yitzhak Molcho, who is Netanyahu's personal envoy, he sends him whenever he wants to get some sort of negotiations done behind the scenes. He is the partner, the law partner of David Shimron, Netanyahu's cousin and confidant. And it seems to be a little too impossible that he didn't know about what was going on either. And so we have a lot of questions that I think at some point Netanyahu's name will become officially attached to this case. And this is, in my opinion, perhaps the most serious case that we have, even though, you know, all of these are have serious implications. And just finally to note the case 4000, this is about the Bezeq telecom company, which is, you know, holds the monopoly on telecom. It's kind of like AT&T during, you know, when it was Ma Bell. There is some sort of competition within the Israeli telecom industry, but not to the same degree as there is in the States. And here, Netanyahu, through his control of the communications ministry, again, we can't say that he himself, but his proxy, Shlomo Filber, who was the director general of the communications ministry, appointed just 2 days after Netanyahu formed his last government in 2015, when he fired the former communications director general who was going to open up new competition into the market. This guy, Filber, has apparently been passing documents, confidential information, to Bezeq to help them. Not only that, but Netanyahu never made a public declaration of his friendship with Shaul Alovich, who is the controlling stakeholder of Bezeq, or his friendship with Arnon Milchin, who is one of the partial stakeholders in Channel 10, one of Israel's two commercial networks. So we're talking about great friendship with all of these telecom moguls that are never being reported, and then favors that are being done for the major telecom company. All of these together, I mean, any one of these individually, maybe, except for the 3000 one, we could say are possibly not such a serious situation, but all of these together, they've given Netanyahu a lot of fear that he may actually be facing personal indictments himself.
Well, things have clearly accumulated over the years, and as you mentioned, even from before he served this past 8 years. But you also mentioned his supporters probably not as concerned about this, but what is the general public response to what's going on here? Are we just, is it being characterized as kind of just a domestic political ploy to try to, you know, associate Netanyahu with things, whatever they can to try to get him out? Are there others that are kind of clamoring to follow Netanyahu? Because it looks to me like there's not even any real clarity on like who the next leader might be, that there's no, you know, kind of mm-hmm. up-and-coming person or people that would be perhaps pushing this in order to topple Netanyahu and take over.
Everything that you've said is true. I mean, first of all, we have his supporters that are unfazed by all of this. He's gone on a Trumpesque rally, series of rallies in the past month. In August, he gave two rallies at the start of the month, the end of the month, for supporters in which he denounced all of this as fake news and the efforts of the left to topple him, and the left and the media to topple him, which is clearly he's taking a page out of Trump's handbook. This is basically played to his audience. They believe in him like they've never believed in him anymore. His fellow ministers and members of his party, many of them have just lined up like ducks to basically support him and say, of course, we are with you. And this is basically a witch hunt from the media. As far as the rest of the population, there we see there's a lot of questions that are being raised. People have grown a lot of tired of Netanyahu. And as someone told me, who's a longtime supporter of the Likud, Netanyahu's party, said to me, you know, it doesn't matter if we like Netanyahu himself. Every now and then a broom gets old and you need to change the broom, right? You can't stick with the same old broom forever because it will collect dust. And here's the case that I think many people, even from the right, are looking at him and saying, you know, maybe it's time for you to step down. On the other hand, on the left, they love this, that basically he's sitting here and holding on to the strings and no one from the left is able to challenge him. If we can topple him from the right, then maybe we'll be competing against someone less charismatic. Now, in the right, people are scrambling to try to compete with him, but without seeming like they're competing with him, because that could play badly against their audience. So a number of senior ministers are trying. The head of another one of these right-wing parties is trying to also position himself in this way. And we should also note the head of the centrist party, Yair Lapid, who is really trying to aim for right-wing voters, is also trying to position himself as the best replacement for Netanyahu. I don't think any of these people can predict anything because we don't know what's going to happen. And Netanyahu has made it clear he's not stepping down even if he's indicted. He's going to sit it out and fight it to the very end. And I don't think we should not trust him on this. I think he doesn't intend to give up his seat very easily. as far as, you know, the ordinary people, you have a series of protests that have been taking place. I mean, granted, most of them, the activists seem to be from the left, but they're protesting outside the home of Avichai Mandelblit, who's the basically the state attorney who is supposed to oversee these investigations. They're protesting him because they think he's dragging his feet on these investigations, and we shouldn't be surprised because he's a close personal friend of the Netanyahu family. But despite all of that, he did issue this indictment against Sarah Netanyahu, and it does look like he's going to allow these indictments to go against Netanyahu. So these protests may start to peter out, but they have been gathering upwards of 1,000 people every week outside of his home. So that does show that there is a great deal of unrest and upset about this.
Well, on that note, and just as we finish very quickly, I mean, I have to ask, because having recently spent some time in Israel, in fact, I visited you when I was there, you know, it seems like it's interestingly the most stable country in the region. I mean, it's incredibly stable right now, despite the few things that happen here or there. But what are the implications for this in terms of some domestic political turmoil and the potential loss of a very strong leader like Netanyahu, whether you like him or not? You know, there is relatively you know, stable situation in Israel. How would any shift affect that kind of stability in the country very quickly?
Well, I think Israel's democratic mechanisms are very strong. So I don't think we're going to see any sort of collapse or any sort of domestic instability that will take place. I think, you know, former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was sent to prison, right? He resigned and then he was sent to prison for corruption as well. And nothing changed in terms of the political scene. I mean, in terms of the stability of the political scene. But what I would note is that at that point in 2007, Abu Mazen, the head of the Palestinian Authority, and Olmert had come to a series of agreements. And basically, Abu Mazen decided, I'm not going to continue with them until we know what happens as a result of these investigations. And it potentially basically forestalled a peace agreement that could have happened. One always wonders. The same thing, I'm not saying that Netanyahu is engaged in peace agreements, but it does mean that any sort of potential negotiations that could happen could be put on hold because the Palestinians will say, let's wait and see what's going to happen to Netanyahu because we're not going to start talking to someone who might not be here in a couple of months.
Yeah, excellent point. All right. Well, thank you so much, Gershom, for being here
today. My pleasure.
You've been listening to my conversation with Gershom Leventhal. He's a visiting professor of Israel Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Borlott.